Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio.
And a very good evening to you. Tonight, in the run-up to the general election, we continue our interviews with the Manx government ministers in Tony Brown's government, who will be seeking re-election when the Isle of Man goes to the polls in September. I'm joined live in the studio by someone who's only been a member of the House of Keys for less than 7 years, but in that time has taken on three of the most important and challenging roles available. He represents more than 2,000 voters, although they weren't called upon last time, with this evening's guest returned unopposed 2 years after he topped the poll at a by-election. I'm talking, of course, about the Education Minister and the Air, MHK, Eddie Teer. Good evening, Mr. Teer.
Good evening.
Chairman of the MEA at a crucial time, Health Minister now, Education. I suppose you'll want the Chief Minister's job next.
Well, I never shirk responsibility, but arguably that would be a bridge too far.
Is that a no?
It could well be a bridge too far, but it depends on the circumstance at the time.
If the election's tomorrow, we look into everything, September, October, a few weeks pass, we're looking at it, it's time for the vote, and you get the vote, would you take the job?
It depends on the others, and it depends on the policies espoused as well. And in politics, the last thing you say is never. You must always keep your options open, but it isn't a job that I go seeking. It isn't a job that I would particularly want. But some of the tasks that I've undertaken in the past have been positions that I really wouldn't have gone running after. But once you get into it, it can be quite rewarding and very fulfilling.
But before politics, of course, you were a manager at the Isle of Man Bank. We need someone who's ruthless with finance over the next 5 years, don't we?
Well, I think you need somebody with experience and also somebody who knows the consequences of actions, because at times you can take a very narrow-based finance decision without considering the wider consequences and complications. And I feel that over the last 7 years, I have demonstrated that I am a good steward of the government's and the taxpayers' finances, but also that I am aware of the consequences as well. I have a good working relationship with the staff bodies. I think that was demonstrated at the Manx Electricity Authority. When I went in there, it was fraught, is the politest way of putting it. But over the first 3 months or so, we managed to get the situation settled down. And in fact, on the first day after my appointment by Tynwald in June 2005 as the chair of the MEA, I had a series of staff briefings just to try and assuage their concerns and try to get the team together so we could work towards a good future. And I feel that's what we've done.
You think the MEA's weathered the financial storm, or should I say, is it now on a sound footing for the future?
There's still work to be done, but at the time that I left, we were £16 million ahead of plan. Our headcount was down by 17%. And when you consider the reaction in other areas to a reduction in headcount, it went through quite smoothly.
At what cost could this be, though, to your grandchildren, my grandchildren, etc., etc.? It's future generations that could potentially be really hit hard still, isn't it?
Well, it's not a cost to the future generations. It's a benefit to the future generations. And two, by buying our gas, which is our fuel to generate electricity forward, we were able to stabilise prices because if you buy on a day-to-day basis, it does introduce considerable volatility into your main cost area. The other thing is too, when I joined the MEA, we were trading electricity with the UK. That was fine, but we were making a profit of approximately £170,000 a year. When I left, we were making £3 million a year. So it isn't only cutting costs, it's also increasing income. And if you can use the assets that you've got to generate, if you pardon the pun, more income, then I think that's a win-win situation.
I mean, something tells me, you were still chairman of the MEA, obviously, at the last election. You turned down, was it in the region of £20,000 a year to take the helm there?
That's correct. I didn't take any salary for my position as chair of the MEA. And I feel that as politicians, we have to lead from the front. And last year, I took a 10% pay cut in my salary as well as a member of Tynwald. And I felt that in view of the unprecedented demands that would be made on the public finances, we had to once again lead by example, and I was pleased that I did it.
You were chairman and health minister, chairman of the MEA and a health minister for the same time for a crossover period. What was the hottest seat ultimately? Was it the health department or was it the MEA?
The health department, because by the time I'd taken up the chair of the DHSS, there were only two big outstanding issues at the MEA to be resolved from a strategic point of view. The main one was the terms of the gas pipeline agreement with Bord Gáis Éireann, who owned the gas pipeline between Moffat in Scotland and just south of Dublin in Éire. Now, I went through the agreements, as I'm sure that you and your listeners would expect. There was a series of agreements, seven or nine in total. And what became apparent was that we had an obligation to pay for that gas pipeline after we had the right to actually use it. So we could have been in the position where
we were cut off. What was your feeling when you discovered that?
Well, like lots of other things, I can't say that I was happy, but you see a problem and you then have to address that problem. So we discussed the position with Bord Gáis Éireann and we renegotiated the contract. So now the contract is settled and in the process of it, we've saved approximately just over £1.5 million a year. So I think that by having a look at things carefully and not accepting everything that you've been told, you can make a difference.
You live at the Len in Kirkandrius?
I do.
Well, once, of course, that sheeding, I think, encompassed Air, Bride, Lazare, it returned three MHKs, I think, at one point. And that was when agriculture was king, if you like. The fact that you were returned unopposed last time would seem to indicate some form of contentment with you. Is that the case, or was it apathy?
No, I would not put it down to complacency. I would say it was so soon, 2 years. No, it was 2 years after the previous by-election. And I think really that people had seen that I was prepared to work hard and also take controversial decisions for what I thought was the best of intentions, that people did trust me. But in a democratic society, I am pleased now that we will be having an election in November. That'll give me a chance to answer for my sins, as it were, on the platform. But I've already started canvassing. I've been round quite a large section of the constituency so far.
You did last time, if I recall, anyway.
Even though there was no election last time, yeah. I did canvass. And funny enough, on Saturday morning when I was out canvassing, one of the constituents I was talking to said how much they appreciated the fact that even though there was no vote last time, I'd taken the trouble to go around canvassing, because I do focus on the constituency and I keep in touch with them. Every year I send out a newsletter and I have three public meetings in the constituency, and that enables me to keep in touch with my constituents.
Will you go against government, even as a minister, when need be? I know you fought against proposals for a new landfill site a couple of years ago in the North of the Island. The Point of Air, of course, was put forward as the Arch Allegan alternative, if you like. Did government ministers go back on the promises they made to the people of Bride?
Well, they did, because
you told them.
In 2004, if I remember correctly, there was a firm promise made to the people of Air and or people of Bride, and that seems to have been completely ignored. So I think every now and again you've got to remind government of what's been said in the past.
Is that difficult to sort of criticise them as a minister?
Not at all. There's this perception that just because you're a member of the Council of Ministers, you have to follow what they call the party line. We're a collection of individuals, and now and again there will be a constituency issue that you cannot sign up to, so you step outside. And I have done that, and I will continue to do that.
Is it still a bone of contention for locals, the tipping?
No, because it's very, very, very little activity at the moment.
You'd acknowledge there needs to be a new landfill somewhere, would you?
I acknowledge there needs to be a new landfill, but that has to be adequately controlled. What astounded me was when that tip proposal was put forward, Dalgy, as it was at the time, couldn't even give details of what they call the waste arising. So that was the volume of waste and the particular type of waste. So until you know what they propose to actually dump there and to use the landfill tip site for, you can't make a valued decision.
Does planning need to, the process need to be more rigorous?
I'm not saying that the process was flawed. I do recognise that there is a national need, but I don't see how anybody can make a decision when you haven't got all the information in front of you.
The major conurbation, of course, in your area, the largely rural area, Andreas, and education and affordable housing, like a lot of places, are worries, and they remain worries, do they?
They do remain concerns. I've been working with the Department of Social Care as it is now, but the Department of Local Government and the Environment as then was, to bring forward a housing development in Bride through a pivoted development order. We got out to public consultation. The public consultation was favourable, except that there was one objection. So as a consequence of that, we've got to go out now to a public planning inspector's appeal. So that will be held. I haven't got the date for that yet, but it's likely to be held in the next 3 months or so. And if it falls before the election, or if I'm re-elected back to represent Ayr, I will be making my representation at that planning inspector's hearing.
Let's move on from Ayr to health, because, of course, for the bulk of this term, you've been a health minister. You've introduced a number of consultations in that time. You were at the centre of a number of contentious issues, mini storms, if you like. I suppose perhaps in this climate as health minister, that will always be the way. But what do you say to those people who say, Eddie Tier, banking background, he knows the cost of everything, the value of nothing?
Well, I would say that just consider all those patients who had operations for cataracts. 800 operations. Now, that was a waiting list initiative brought forward. The other thing was, there's been quite a lot of controversy lately over breast cancer treatment. Now, I was the minister who brought in breast cancer or breast screening call and recall. Now, that was brought in January 2008. Unlike the UK, we test, or we give the option to our ladies and gentlemen as well, up to a certain point, to have a mammogram every 2 years. In the UK, it's 3 years. So we had to get the technology together so that the scans could be transmitted electronically to where they're read in Coventry. And that's been very, very successful. So I do feel that we took the first steps at that time to put in place what has proved to be a first-class service.
Didn't take long, did it, for you to upset someone in health? A matter of weeks, in fact. The man who sits next to you week in, week out, read the provision of GP surgery in Kirkmichael.
Well, I always feel that if somebody has an issue, they should come and talk to me.
I mean, Timwell did approve this, the money was there, and then it was pulled. You could understand the anger.
I can understand the anger and I can appreciate the concern, but what I felt was I couldn't identify where the funding was coming from within the department's budgets. As it was going to be a completely new GP surgery, there would have to be a subvention, that's a subsidy, of £300,000 each year for 5 years until that surgery became viable. Now, we just couldn't do it. I just couldn't see where we could find £300,000 a year.
And will a £1.8 million facility in Jerby be any different?
Well, yes, it will, because that is going to be operated as a satellite operation by the Ramsey GPs, and there were severe problems with the footprint of the GP surgery in Ramsey. It's, in effect, on a postage stamp-style site. There's no room for expansion.
Expensive, though, isn't it? £1.8 million in Jerby for a satellite style where doctors have to travel to and from.
I would say to you that we would have had to have built anywhere. There were proposals to move to a new GP surgery in Gardeners Lane. But if you have a look at that, it also services the prison as well. It provides facilities for nurses who will be servicing the prison. And additionally, it is a community centre. So instead of just having a look at one particular aspect, health, we're having a look at services to the community as well. And I think that's not a bad thing, because it is joined up government. It demonstrates we're caring for the community.
Expensive beast, health. You don't need me to tell you that. Expensive beast to run. How do we continue to fund our healthcare and remain in a position where we can meet the needs of the community?
That's a conundrum. Some would say the $64,000 question.
Is there a solution?
Really, it's going to be very difficult going forward, because as procedures become more complex, they become more expensive, and also drugs become more expensive as well. And we have many difficult decisions to take going forward. But if you have a look at productivity for a start, that's a good illustration. I was concerned with the increase in the waiting list for certain orthopaedic operations, so myself and Mrs. Crowe, as it was then, met the orthopaedic consultants one evening, and we discussed working practices, how they structured their activity. And it became clear that they kept one theatre session, that's half a day per week, for what they call trauma cases. That means that those who are involved in accidents, and if there was no cases, then they didn't undertake any activity. So what we agreed with them was that they would accept a standby list. So if there weren't any patients presenting through trauma, then we had patients there who would be brought forward. And that helps to manage productivity. So every now and again, if you have a look at how you do it, you can deliver more for the same amount of money. Now, my record proves that we can deliver more on a finite budget.
I mean, we could talk for hours about strategic issues facing society, the economy. That's just on health alone, of course. But we know a future of difficult decisions, tightening of funding awaits. A couple of points. Should universal benefits continue?
That is very difficult to justify in the present environment. I honestly don't. I haven't got a firm thought on it. I'm not ducking the question because there has been research done in the UK. There's an interesting paper done by Frank Field, the Labour MP for Birkenhead. And bearing in mind his background, he was more, shall I say, adventurous than I was. But I feel that his ideas have a certain logic to them, but I wouldn't want to impose anything on anybody. Whatever we do after the next election will be driven by the financial pressures upon us, but I would wish to see a consensual approach to how we balance our budgets.
But we'll come to finance after. Care in the community, I mean, what we've constantly been told from you, and I know it's not Department of DHSS anymore, but we've got health, we've got social care. We're constantly told people want to live as independently as possible. Do they? Or is it just cost-cutting? I know at one point you halted admissions to three of the long-stay care homes.
Well, OK.
That decision was reversed.
Well, if I could just take that. That decision, which was reversed for political reasons because of the pressure.
Financial pressure.
No, because of the pressure which was exerted on the department. Now, that decision was wrong, manifestly wrong, because
The decision to reverse the decision was wrong, or the decision to introduce it was wrong?
The decision to introduce it was right. We get more bangs for our bucks, as it were, by supporting people in their own homes. We can support eight people in their own homes for the cost of supporting one.
So an overhaul of the way the island looks after its elderly was the right way to go in your mind?
Undoubtedly was the right way to go.
So who gave in to the pressure? The civil servants?
No, the politicians. I just couldn't get it through Tynwald. And every now and again, there's the perception that the council ministers has a block vote. Now, you made a good illustration of there where we were defeated. Now, you've got to acknowledge defeat. It's not a dictatorship, it's a democracy. But if we had have got that through, then we would have enabled more people to stay in their own communities, in their own homes, for longer. And I don't think that's bad at all.
Drug and alcohol unit. The island needs a special drug and alcohol unit. We're constantly told we'll have to wait till the funds are found. That wait's going to go on for some time now, one suggests.
No, because there has been a subsequent review done. And the opinion now, the professional opinion now, is that we don't actually need an inpatient drug and alcohol unit, because that's what you're alluding to. The daycare and actually helping people to get away from their dependency is still there. But the controversy was over the 24-hour care. Now, it's been said now that by the professionals, because I'm not a professional, I don't write prescriptions.
Trust your civil servants?
Well, what I do trust them, but I don't take everything for granted. And when you get a briefing paper, you quite quickly have an opinion as to what the turning point, the key facts of the argument are. And then I go back and say, and I'll pick out, say, two or three of the key facts, and I'll say, can I have the underlying data on that? So nobody knows which section I'm going to question. So that means that the paper has to be right, in my opinion, but you have to do your homework.
Two very issues that I wanted to touch upon. Hyperbaric chamber. Is that properly funded, in your view, by government?
Yes, it is, because the hyperbaric chamber has to acknowledge that it's not part of the mainstream healthcare. I did receive conflicting advice from the department on it, but I did support it. And I went down, I met with the organisers and the trustees, and we agreed a way forward. I also did discuss the position with a private benefactor, and we managed to raise some funds from them, which the department matched. So I thought that we did rather well. But what I would hope is...
A private benefactor in the north of the island.
That's correct, yes. Yeah. And he was very kind, very, very good.
Was it publicly known that you did that?
We did mention it at the time, right. But like everything else...
People remember what they want to remember, do they?
People have a selective memory, and I was going to say, and this is no criticism of your good self, but good news tends not to be news at times.
Let's talk about the hospice then. Annual running costs of up to £4 million. As minister, you were actually instrumental in ensuring an agreement with hospice where, I think, by government provided annual funding of around £600,000 and other support. Could government do more, or is that fair?
I don't think it's fair, because we've done a considerable amount of... Or we have delivered a considerable amount of support to hospice. If you take the actual cash
Is
payment,
that enough, do you think?
Well, everybody would say...
Will it ever be enough?
It's never going to be enough. Every organisation, every third party that we work with is always looking for more funding. But we had to be realistic. There's only so many times we can spend the £1. But it isn't only the money that we gave to hospice. It was the extra services that we provided, the support that we provided from the hospital, the drugs, the laundry, insurance, everything else. So that adds up to quite a bit on top. And in addition to that, we cover the pensions for the hospital staff.
We know you were hit unexpectedly by financial demands midway through your tenure in health. Of course, there's no two subjects more likely to provoke strong feelings than health and education. And that was certainly the case, and it would be remiss of me not to mention that the campaign to save the reciprocal health deal. Was it, in your view, a combination of political and public pressure that swayed that, or did you and your colleagues do all the work? Or indeed, did they misjudge the strength of public opinion?
Right. I feel that we did do a lot of work, but I do acknowledge it's been a team effort here.
Including the public?
Including the public, because it wasn't an easy thing. We did have negotiations in London. Whilst Mr. Burnham, the then UK Health Minister, was very courteous, we couldn't get him to change his mind. And we had to
acknowledge. Something did.
The pressure. I understand that when he was out canvassing for the May 2009 general election in his constituency in the northwest of England, he was asked by one of his constituents why they were doing it. And he suddenly realised that it was an issue. So he then made a political decision to overturn the advice from his officials. And
they weren't happy, the officials, were they?
I wouldn't think they would be. But what we have to acknowledge is...
What exactly did government do to try and save it, though?
Well, the first thing is we took a policy to Tynwald, and that was in October 2009, and that was basically self-insure. And we then went back to put a safety net in place for those who wouldn't have the means to buy an insurance policy, or for those who had pre-existing medical conditions where it wouldn't be possible for them to get insurance at a reasonable rate. The way that the reciprocal health agreement has worked out, we've given the UK nearly £3 million extra. They don't have to make that payment to us now. So we're picking up this burden. So from their point of view, it was a relatively easy decision to make, because the actual cost of it falls on the Isle of Man.
We're nearly out of time. There's health, there's education. Is it too many issues to touch upon there in a few minutes, but is it snip, snip, snip in education? I know you've reassured the teachers about their jobs where possible. Students going to universities, could we face a time when there's no grants at all? What assurance can you give teachers?
I can't give any assurances to anybody, because I don't know what our financial position is going to be next year or the year afterwards. And it would be wrong of any politician to give cast iron, copper bottom assurances. That I will not do.
On the VAT issue, we know there's a statement next week. Do you know, as a minister, as a member of the House of Keys, what's coming?
No.
Have you an inkling?
I...
Have all members got an inkling?
Well,
if not a ballpark figure?
There are straws in the wind, and that's been flagged up by both the Treasury Minister and the Chief Minister. So that's public knowledge, and we've got to set our stalls out now. So what I'm anxious to do is to resolve the uncertainty as quickly as possible.
Are you Steady Eddie or Edward Scissorhands?
Steady, somebody with a super track record, somebody who can do and not who says that they can do. I've got a good record and I'm content to go to the polls again based on that record.
Eddie Tia, thank you very much indeed for your time this evening.
My pleasure.
Election 2011 coverage on Manx Radio.